Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to exist in one of the most barren environments on Earth, made harsher by poverty and the ever-present specter of war? After journalist Anna Bodkin began visiting the 40-hut village of Oka, Afghanistan, she attempted to locate it on a map and discovered it was too small to be documented either on paper or by the omnipresent eye of Google. And yet the place is there. It is home to multiple generations, some of whom will live and die nearby without ever straying beyond the region where the grasp of poverty and hunger are too strong to escape. Anna Bodkin shares the stories of the people who welcomed her into their lives and homes in her new book, The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Anna, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's nice to be back.
What drew you to Oka as a subject?
I first came to Oka in 2010 at an invitation of a friend who was working with me as a driver. He said, I've got to show you something. You've got to see this. And we drove across the desert, a roadless desert, to a small hillock upon which about 40 cob homes rose and nothing else. There were sand dunes to the north and to the south and the east and the west. There was just this hussocked desert. This was probably one of the most destitute villages I've ever seen in my life, and I've traveled around the global south quite a bit, and I've seen a lot of poverty. And yet, this was also the place where women wove the most beautiful carpets in the world. And that friction between the incredible beauty and unspeakable poverty and violence that was being perpetrated upon those plains pierced me. And I was only there for a few hours, and I realized that what I wanted to do was to come back and stay as long as it takes to weave a carpet.
I was struck by your description that there are no trees within the village, and there are no trees visible from the village.
It is absolutely barren. It's an alkaline plain in northern Afghanistan that is being engulfed by sand as we speak, partially as a result of man-made catastrophes resulting from the policies of the Soviet Union in the 80s when Leonid Brezhnev, the head of the Communist Party, decided to turn back some rivers to irrigate some land that had not been irrigated before. And partially because of the war, a lot of trees are being chopped down and actually yanked out of the ground for firewood, for kindling. So this is a very, very remote village in the middle of this absolute desert.
So talk about the conditions in which, and it's pretty much exclusively women, are working on these carpets.
Women and girls. Mm-hmm. They will squat upon a horizontal loom strung with plain undyed yarn, wool yarn, and they will pick up a thread. Maybe it will be a burgundy thread or an ochre thread or a maroon thread, and tie that thread around the loom a couple of times and then cut it off with a sickle and continue doing that for hours. And it takes about between 4 and 9 months to weave a carpet, depending on how many people are working on the carpet, how large the loom is, and how many distractions there are in the weaver's life. And that, I think, is a very important thing to understand. You know, we talk about women, especially in Afghanistan, very often we see them as victims, victims of violence, victims of brutality of men, victims of traditions. And that is a gross oversimplification. In fact, in their households, many women are matriarchs, and they certainly are not part of some kind of slave labor. It's extremely hard to weave a carpet. It tortures. The pain of squatting day in and day out on top of a loom is very, very hard. However, because the woman knows that she will be doing this for her entire life, she takes breaks. You know, she goes out to stretch and gossip with her neighbors. She disappears for 2 weeks at a wedding of her sister in a different village. So it's, you know, life happens around that carpet. And that also was what attracted me to the process of production, because the carpet really becomes a diary of a woman's season at the loom.
So every single knot is done by hand, and I still can't quite get my mind around this. A carpet might take 1.2 million individual knots.
Yes, the optimal density of a carpet, and the carpet's beauty is judged, among other things, by its density, the density of its weave. The optimal density of a pile carpet is believed to be about 240 knots per square inch. Hmm. That is a lot of knots.
Yeah. And the other way that the quality and the beauty of carpets can be judged is one that might take people by surprise.
Yes. When the carpet merchant looks at a rug that is brought to him by the family, the husband or the father or the father-in-law of a weaver, the first thing he will do is he will turn the carpet pile side in and run his fingernail against the weave to hear, to listen to the density of its weave. He can actually hear it. Mm-hmm. And so having established that the carpet is woven with approximately 240 knots per square inch, he will then turn it pile side out, and he will look not for the intricacy of the design, because he says design is a matter of taste, but for mistakes in the design. Because each mistake in that design makes this particular carpet a unique travelogue of its weaver's life.
Why is it just the women who weave? Because there's nothing inherently, you know, you don't need to be a woman to do this work. Why are the men not sort of doubling the potential for income?
Somebody has to go out to the desert and collect caligonum, which is this dry thistle-like grass, so that it can be brought into other villages as kindling and bartered for rice and oil and some wheat flour for the bread. Somebody has to take the camels out to pasture. The men of Oka are not layabouts. They work as well. They perform their part of this very primitive and almost non-monetary economy. So everybody has a role and everybody plays a role. For example, the family on which my book is focused, the patriarch of the family is a hunter, and so is his son, because such professions are sort of inherited. So Baba Nazar, the hunter, goes out with his old Soviet shotgun into the desert and hunts whatever comes across at him. Now, of course, he has been complaining that in the last couple of decades there have been fewer animals in the desert, and he suggested that perhaps that has been because too many men have weapons now.
Hmm. And he is a good hunter to the extent that if anybody in the village gets meat on occasion, it is his family.
He is, I think, a very good hunter. He is probably in his 70s. Nobody really knows how old anybody is. Baba Nazar explained to me that when he was a little boy, his mother would tell him, now you're 5, now you're 7, now you're 10. But then at one point his mother died, and there was nobody to tell him how old he was. And when his beard became completely gray, he decided to settle on 70 because it sounded like such a respectable number. And he is such a respectable old man, an elder in Oka. When I met him in 2010, he said he was 70. When I saw him again a year later, he said he was 70. When I bid farewell to him for the last time, almost a year later, he was still 70. So, but, you know, he's a very experienced hunter. And sometimes he would hunt things that would trouble me, but not the people of Oka. One time he hunted demoiselle cranes out of the sky using rat poison. And I found that to be very disturbing. And it bothered me for a long time. I felt really violated by that. And then I realized that in a village that is so removed from any help, even a crane is not a sacred bird. It is a source of protein.
What did it take to, I mean, it seems like Baba Nazar and his family were very welcoming to you. Did it take a while to become comfortable knowing that if you were there, you would be sharing in their meager food supplies? And how did all that work for you?
Yeah, you know, it's always an ethical issue when I work in places where people are usually extremely poor. There is, I do experience a little bit of guilt because I am going to be taking some of their food. So sometimes when I know that I will be staying at somebody's house for a while, I do what I do when I'm coming to somebody's house in the United States. You know, here I would bring a bottle of wine. There I'll bring a bag of rice, for example, or some onions, something from the town that will be a valuable contribution to the dinner table and also something that may be a little bit of a delicacy, like, for example, canned tomato paste. So I always try to contribute a little bit to the dinner tables of the people who I know will be hosting me.
There are times when it's cheaper for people to buy opium than it is to buy rice. And if you're hungry, it's easier to take a hit of opium than to eat.
Indeed. Indeed. This is a very old tradition. Some historians believe that Alexander the Great introduced opium to Afghanistan when he invaded that part of the world 2,300 years ago. In 327 BC, his army used opium as a palliative, and then the army mostly left and the opium mostly stayed, and it is a very easily accessible palliative indeed. Medicine, the way people in the West know it, ibuprofen, for example, is absolutely inaccessible, and the nearest hospital, a district hospital, not a very good hospital at all, is a 7.5-hour walk away. So, of course, if you are a parent of 6 children and one of them becomes sick, if you wanted to take that child to the hospital, that would mean that you would have to leave all the other children behind, and who will look after them? And who knows how much money you would have to spend at the hospital, whereas here is your little stash of opium resin, and all you need to do is pinch a tiny little bit off the ball and dilute it in some tea, and here's your painkiller.
My guest is journalist Anna Bodkin. Her new book is called The World is a Carpet, 4 Seasons in an Afghan Village. We'll come back to the conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Anna Bodkin. Her new book is called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. You were speaking before the break, Anna, about the terrible calculus that families have to make if they have a critically ill child. Do you leave the others behind? How do you handle that? You went with one family whose infant needed hospital care, it became clear. And then when you got there, they were just treated with the greatest disrespect and disregard.
Yeah, the nurse who was the only person, the only member of personnel present at the pediatric ward of this little district hospital when we arrived, basically tried to turn the family away. And what happened was interesting because the family was the parents of the 40-day-old infant who was suffering from acute malnutrition were so stunned at the nurse's response that they just stood there and didn't turn around, didn't leave. And the nurse mistook their confusion for mulishness and said, okay, put your child here on the table. And I think it's possible that maybe my presence in the room also encouraged the nurse to call a doctor. So she called the pediatrician who was not in the hospital. He was someplace else, probably eating his lunch at home. He came and he also tried to not look at the baby, not treat the baby. But the father of the baby insisted that the baby be at least looked at. And finally, the doctor said, this child needs immediate care. We're taking him. He's going to spend 3 days here. His mother will stay with him. And, you know, assigned a regimen for the baby. I think that what happened there was this apathy that takes over when you work at a clinic that has very little to offer. Hmm. And you know that people around you will continue to die at alarming rate. Afghanistan has the highest infant mortality rate in the world. One in four children in Afghanistan doesn't live to be the age of five. Mm. One in eight mothers dies in childbirth. So it's healthcare is a tremendous problem. And even in that clinic, in that pediatric ward, the staff had very, very little to offer other than their sagging cots and their dirty walls and some sort of semblance of treatment.
And the people in the village told you that it's almost something they've come to expect, that every winter they'll lose five or six children from that tiny
village. Indeed. There is a family in Oka who had been married. When I met them, they had been married for 9 years. They had five daughters, and each of them died before reaching the age of two.
Hmm. Yeah. So I guess malnutrition is an issue. There's no access to health care. How do these families sort of deal with the children they have? Do they seem to have a different relationship to the fear that something could happen to their children than we might have in the developed world?
Definitely. The level of fear between the difference between the level of fear in the West and in the global South is tremendous, not just in Afghanistan, but everywhere. And I grew up in the global South. And of course, I recognize more how people in Afghanistan raise children than how people in the United States raise children. But I also, you know, if you talk to older people in the States, they'll say, well, we never had helmets when we rode our bike. We drank from the garden hose. I think that there is a very strong sense of fear in general that it permeates the Western culture now, that takes a background role in the global South, possibly because there are other things to be really concerned about. For example, suicide bombings, mm-hmm. you know, an air raid, things that you absolutely cannot control. Having said that, the problem is not just malnutrition, Chris. The problem is illiteracy. And I'm not just talking about the inability to read and write. I'm talking about the lack of knowledge about infection and disease and how it works and how it spreads and how to stop it. And you don't really need significant or expensive medication, for example, to treat a common cold. But there seems to be very little understanding how to deal with a common cold, or even among mothers, little recognition when their child begins to be ill. Hmm. So treatment only happens if it does happen, and it doesn't happen a lot. But the resorting to any kind of treatment only takes place when the patient, the person, the child or an adult, is in critical condition.
Hmm. So the son, the adult son of the family that you stayed with, Baba Nadar's son, is always dreaming about sort of escaping the village and his life there. Can you talk about the kinds of plans that he would hatch for himself just during the time that you spent in the village and with the family?
Oh, Amanullah is wonderful. He is such a dreamer. He dreams, for example, of running away from Afghanistan to Turkmenistan because, he says, girls in Turkmenistan sing beautifully. His plan was to go to Turkmenistan, make a lot of money, and spend it all on the girls. And he loves his wife. But he says, you know, it's only one wife, and it's kind of boring. And then he says something I can't repeat here on the radio. You know, that's all he knows. And he wishes for some diversity. He also once told me that he wants a big house with a big gate, and behind that gate, a car. Hmm. He sometimes wishes that he could run away and go to Mazar-e-Sharif, which is a big city in northern Afghanistan, and do what there? And then when he does come to Mazar-e-Sharif, he becomes one of those migrants that populate most megapolises in the world now, especially in the global south. He gets lost. He gets nervous. He loses his stature physically. He sort of hunches over, and he's uncertain how to deal with traffic and with crowds of people. And he once came to Mazar-e-Sharif hoping to spend the night and then basically couldn't. He said the noise gave him a headache. And so he went back to his village where there is no electricity and no traffic of any kind, no noise.
Well, let's talk about the electricity, because there was a project some years back to electrify the village that seems to have just been a complete waste.
I think that project epitomizes international aid to Afghanistan. To me, at least, it does, because projects like this took place not just in Okab, but in villages back of beyond in Afghanistan, everywhere. And we should probably explain to the listeners that 80%, that's 8 out of 10 people in Afghanistan, live in villages, very, very rural setting. So some years ago, some do-gooders bought a radiator and sent a team of construction workers to Oka. The team built a special dwelling for the radiator. It's the only building that has straight angles. They also put up 12 aluminum electric posts and ran a power line from one post to another, though not connecting it to anything else, and delivered a generator and put that generator inside the generator house and left. The men of Oka filled the generator with fuel and ran it nonstop for as long as it ran. And then, even though they cannot read and write, they were able to make the calculation, figure out how much it would cost them to buy fuel, even to run that generator 1 or 2 hours a night, and realize that the village could not afford that. There simply is not enough money to run that generator. So that generator still sits in the generator house. It's treated with respect. The men decided that so that the children don't mess up the wires that came with the generator, a man should be entrusted with those wires. And so now the wires are coiled up in somebody's house. And the aluminum posts in the village provide a fantastic opportunity for a target shooting practice for kids who use slingshots to ding and ding those aluminum posts.
It's like a really good noise when they actually hit one.
Exactly. And it's also pretty controllable, much more so than the megapolis noise.
Did you ever ask the young woman in Baba Nazar's family, his daughter-in-law, Thaura? Did you ever ask her how she felt about her work on the carpet? Or do you think she'd ever thought to ask that question of herself?
You know, asking Thaura how she feels about her work is sort of like asking her how she feels about breathing. It's something that she's done from when she was probably 3 or 4. She probably started helping her mother at that age, because that's usually the age when little girls start helping their mothers on the loom. And she will be doing this forever. She complains about backache and joint pain because it's hard work to squat for hours on end on top of a carpet and tie knots. It is. It's physically very, very taxing. Mm-hmm. But it's not a question of choice. She doesn't have anything else that she could be doing instead. And she couldn't not be weaving carpets because that's her family's main monetary income.
So when she's finished with the carpet, she gets the equivalent of a couple of $100s, or the family does when it goes to sale.
The family does.
Yeah. How much is that worth somewhere in the West? How much is the carpet worth at retail?
When that carpet arrives in a dealership in Dallas or New York or San Francisco, it probably will cost between $5,000 and $20,000. When all said and done, it looks like Thaura will get about 40 cents a day for her work on this carpet.
I wonder what that was like for you, you know, with a foot obviously there in Afghanistan, but also knowing, you know, the value of this thing elsewhere. Was there part of you that thought, I can buy this from her for 10 times what she's making now? I mean, do you have to fight those instincts to remain simply an observer rather than a full participant in people's lives?
Well, Chris, between us and everybody else who's listening, I actually can't afford to buy that carpet for 10 times what she's going to
Well,
to
I won't
sell
be right. but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Interesting question. My job takes me to places where I feel extremely inadequate to people's pain, and physical pain, emotional pain, all sorts of hardship that I know that I cannot alleviate. So let's say I buy Thaura's carpet for, you know, what I can afford, which probably would be, you know, twice the price of that carpet. But what about Thaura's neighbor's carpet? And what about her neighbor's carpet? The difficulty of telling stories from, you know, what they call in Mexico los de abajo, those from the bottom, from those edges of the world, is that you are helpless, and you know you are helpless. And so the best you can do is bring some cans of tomato paste from the town and have a feast.
Did they always know ahead of time when you were coming? Were you able to sort of get word to them before you would arrive?
I made a point of not getting word to the village before I would arrive for security reasons. The road between Mazar-e-Sharif, where I was based, I was living in a house with a big family. And Oka, the village, is a very unsafe road, and it's becoming increasingly unsafe. There are bandits, there are robbers, there are Taliban, there are insurgents of other kinds. So if somebody accidentally told somebody else, oh, Anna is coming to visit us tomorrow, and that somebody else told somebody else, and that somebody else turned out to want to make a little cash, then we wouldn't be talking right now, because Westerners in Afghanistan at the time were being kidnapped for ransom.
So initially when you started visiting, the people of Oka said, well, we're too small, nobody really cares about us, including the Taliban. But they did, in fact, make their presence known.
They did. And the sense of unease descended on Oka. Thing is that people in Oka don't necessarily worry about the Taliban overrunning their village, because there's absolutely nothing that the Okans can give. When the Taliban overruns a village, it then demands a 10% tithe, the religious tax. And people of Oka don't have any money to pay that tithe, and the Taliban probably are aware of that. But people of Oka do travel, and sometimes they will go down to a village to barter kindling for food, and then they will be coming back with that food, and that can be taken. So roads around Oka become more and more dangerous, and that worries the people of the village.
My guest is journalist Anna Bodkin. Her new book is called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Anna Bodkin. Her new book is called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It took the people of Oka a while to figure out what you were doing there or what you were not doing there. Some people thought you were some kind of aid worker. Will you talk about their impressions of you initially?
I'm a very odd insertion into the life of Oka, because people of Oka know about the presence of non-soldiers, Westerners in Afghanistan, because they listen to the radio. So they know that billions of international aid are being pumped into Afghanistan. And that, of course, is a source of major frustration, not just in Oka, but elsewhere, because they never do see that aid. So here I come alone, unarmed, and I'm not going to build anything. I'm not going to build a well. I'm absolutely useless. And in fact, at one point, Baba Nazar, the patriarch of the family on which is the focus of my book, explained to somebody, she's useless.
and not unkindly. He just was trying to let them know she can't do anything for you.
I think he actually was also trying to a little bit to protect me, because if people thought I were an aid worker, then people would think, this is his thinking, people would think that I have money. Mm-hmm. And if I have money, then, well, let's see if we can overpower this woman and take her wallet. He knew that I didn't have money, and he knew that I wasn't an aid worker. So he was trying to protect me a little bit from potential attackers. But I tried to explain that I was writing a book about Oka, and that didn't resonate at all because nobody had ever seen a book. The idea that anybody would read a book was very strange because nobody had ever met anybody who'd read one. And then we were talking about the tsunami in Japan. This is in 2011 and in the spring. And the people of Oka were listening to the only shortwave radio in the village, which belongs to Baba Nazar. And I said, you know, you're talking about that tsunami. You know about it because somebody like me is there in Japan telling the story of the people of Japan on the radio. And that resonated completely. And I heard Amanullah later tell somebody, this is Anna, and she is telling our story. She's going to be telling our story on the radio. And here I am, Chris, telling that story on the radio.
There
so it was
go.
Absolutely, yeah, there you go.
It's all come true. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Joe calling from Dallas. Hello, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a two-part question, actually. The first question is for Anna. Does she speak the language Pashto or Dari or Farsi? And the second question is, who are these people, the dealers who are dealing these carpets in the States or in Europe? Are they Afghans or are they made up of different, Americans, Europeans? Who are these people and how do they sleep at night?
I love your second question. Thank you, Joe. I speak a little bit of Farsi and probably not anymore, but when I lived in Afghanistan for months at a time, I spoke fairly decent Farsi. Indeed, who are these people who make money off of the labor of these women and not just the dealers who are selling carpets to you and to other customers in the United States, but the middlemen, because the carpet dealer who buys Thawra's carpet for $200 then sells it for $220. That's his profit. Then the carpet dealer in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, will sell a similar carpet for $400. So there is somewhere in between happens a markup of almost 100%. And then who are the people in between who live off of that labor so spectacularly?
Hmm. Was Thawra and were her friends aware of how much that carpet was worth elsewhere? Or in their minds, do they sort of settle on the $200 figure and that's all they can think about?
They're not aware. Well, they weren't aware until I talked to them. And even then, the concept of $20,000 is really, really difficult to wrap your mind around. It's like the concept of $20 million is hard for an average American to wrap his or her mind around. Mm-hmm. And of course, no, Chris, they wanted more money. Who wouldn't? I mean, they knew that they were living in poverty. They weren't living an easy life. Sometimes they wouldn't have any protein for days on end to eat. And sometimes there wasn't even enough rice for dinner. So if they could have sold the carpet for more money, they would have. But unfortunately, nobody was offering.
I was struck when you asked Baba Nazar about their plans to fast for Ramadan. And he said, are you crazy?
Essentially, yes. Because, of course, they fast every day in Oka. Mm-hmm. Ramadan is a month-long fast during which you're not supposed to eat between sunup and sundown. And most people in Mazar-e Sharif were observing it. And when I came to visit, on the second day of Ramadan, I came to visit the people of Oka. They said, we're fasting every day. Why are we going to starve ourselves to death? You know, if we don't have this morsel now, then we will probably die.
How aware are people in the cities and the urban centers of Afghanistan of what life is like? I know there's been migration from rural areas to urban areas. Does the average, resident of Mazar-e Sharif know about places like Oka?
Yes, because the average resident of Mazar-e Sharif has relatives, who live in a place maybe not quite like Oka, but similarly poor and forsaken. So most people in Afghanistan, I think, are aware that the hinterlands are tremendously poor and very hard to live in. Not that life in Mazar-e Sharif is, you know, easy. Mm-hmm. It's not milk and honey by any stretch of imagination for most people. But and of course, everybody sees, even people who have never been outside the city, I don't believe such people exist, but everybody sees the poor migrants come in from outside and what they look like and what they're wearing and what they're buying in the market and how they bargain and what they're bargaining for. So you can, you know, the difference, as in the most of the world, the difference between the city and the rural is pretty striking.
What was your sense of time and the era in which you were existing when you would go and stay in Oka? Because you talk about these, you know, certain traditions in terms of what people are eating and the way they're making carpets that could be hundreds or even thousands of years old, and yet there are, you know, airplanes streaking across the sky and that sort of thing.
Sort of like this temporal chasm. You're standing on the lip of a grand canyon of time. You're sitting down on a on a woolen rug or on a blanket next to men who have just returned with their camels from collecting thistle for kindling, and then one of them, and they're barefoot and they're wearing the same kind of clothes they have been wearing for millennia. And in the loom room, a woman is weaving a carpet the same way she has done, her ancestors had done for since time immemorial. And then all of a sudden, one of these men whips out a cell phone and starts dialing his friend in a nearby village. And then you do hear a B-52 rumble overhead, or somebody, you know, tells about a suicide bombing that destroyed something and killed people in the big city. So all these times congeal around you, and it's a very, it gives you a bit of vertigo. It gives me a bit of vertigo.
Did you find yourself wishing to either go back in time or move forward in time? Like, would one necessarily be better than the other if you had to choose?
Oh, I loved being there and bearing witness and telling stories and listening to stories exactly when I was there. Hmm. I wish I could have stayed longer. I always do wish I could have stayed longer.
Is there any effort, Anna, by the Afghan government to provide education to residents of these very small little hamlets?
Little or none. Mm-hmm. In fact, the government is paying two teachers who supposedly are coming to Oka and teaching the children of Oka. The teachers had never been. I found those teachers who are collecting this money. And they said, where's that? So, you know, Oka is very far away. There was once a mullah who would come and read the Friday prayer and also teach the children from time to time. But then, and the people of Oka paid him themselves. But then the price of fuel rose and the mullah asked for more money so that he could pay for fuel for his motorbike, and the villagers simply said that we can't afford that either. So the mullah stopped coming. The sense of abandonment is not just in Oka, Chris. The sense of abandonment is in the entire country, especially in rural communities. It's heartbreaking that it will have to stay this way, because now, you know, the West is pulling, NATO is pulling out its troops. The West's attention is moving on or away from Afghanistan. And I don't think that the people of Oka or people of any other similarly rural and poverty-stricken, disease-stricken community in Afghanistan have a lot to look forward to in terms of assistance. And why should they look for assistance? You know, somebody may ask, why shouldn't they just pull themselves up by their bootstraps? And I guess my answer would be, it is our responsibility, because we have contributed to the destruction of the last 12 years just by simply by waging a war in that land and preventing infrastructure from developing. I think it behooves us to do something better than, you know, funnel money into a kleptocracy in Kabul and ignore the rest of the country. I think that there is a sense of responsibility.
Anna, can you talk about one toward the end of your time working in and observing life and recording life in Oka? Bamanazar said to you, again, not unkindly, look, I've welcomed you many times in the past, but I think it's better this time if you don't stay.
It broke my heart. It was my last visit to the village, and it was really, really hard to get there because it was in winter and the desert had become this slush that was impassable even by donkey. You had to walk on foot, and it took me a while to get to Oka. And people were very nervous. They were worried that their shotguns were inadequate against a raid by insurgents or kidnappers. And it broke my heart also, not because I was, you know, I felt rejected. I did not feel rejected. It broke my heart because I saw this trepidation in Baba Nazar's voice, and I realized how difficult it was for him to suddenly withdraw his welcome from me, because I know that he loved me. I mean, we had developed a very, very close, very intimate friendship, Oka and I. And it hurt tremendously that village was now not only poor and forsaken and abandoned, but also afraid.
The new book by journalist Anna Bodkin is called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Anna, it's always such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, learn about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. That subscription is free. And, of course, we also welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.